Over starting now? Live from Burbank, California, where every Tuesday gasoline is free, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's doing a heck of a job. Mark Maron!
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Your numbers are becoming fewer as each day passes, I believe. I think you guys are waking up to the reality that this administration has run our country into the mud and may be bringing the world to the end of its course in terms of human occupation of said planet, Jim? Yes? Make me stop. I can't get any higher.
Take
Jim.
A breath. Breath.
Thank you. Thank God. Thank goodness you told me to breathe. Now I can calm the hell down. Who put the chocolate ruglach in the pantry there? They got chocolate ruglach. Do you know what ruglach is, Jim?
You mean arugula?
Rugula. Rugula.
Rugula.
Rugula. Rugula.
Is that some sort of Mideast
dessert? I think it's the Jewish Hebraic pronunciation is rugula. 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 Arugula? Rugula. Rugula.
It's chewy, chewy chocolate?
Chewy, chewy chocolate cookies. Post-Passover, really good. I can't eat anymore. Look, I'm not going to meander about food. A lot of things happen today. I want to tell people what's going to be on the show. Our show today is filled with information. Today is an information show. Today is a show where we get things done. We get to the bottom of it. From Time Magazine, Massimo Calabrese will be here to talk about the best and worst senators from a piece he wrote. I've got some ideas myself, but they apparently spoke to many people, ex-former senators. They spoke to historians. So their context is going to be informed and a little different than mine, but I am curious to see who is chosen. The author of American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century, Kevin Phillips, will talk to us about one of the best books ever written. This is a guy who also wrote the book Dynasty, a big Bush critic, a one-time Republican political strategist who turned. I'd like to talk to him a little bit about that, but there's so much in the book that I'd rather talk about that than to address him personally. He really charts the history of the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade, of the politics and imperial pursuit of oil and other energy resources throughout the history of mankind and what that has led to. He's got some historical precedents to show just what overreaching hubris and inability to manage has reaped upon other imperial nations, going back to, I believe, Holland and the whale oil biz, my friend.
Oh, Holland, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Uh-huh. And from the Ostroy Report at ostroyreport.blogspot.com, Andy Ostroy will be here to talk politics. I've been a fan of his blog for a while. It's very simple. It's not complicated. He's just a guy that writes some stuff about politics every day. He was one of the first guys to get me on the Gore for President in 2008 tip, and I think he's right on about that. I like the way he thinks and writes, so we'll get to that in just a little while. It was a big day. I don't know what it really means to have Karl Rove stepping aside, kind of, not really. I mean, Karl Rove is giving up his policy development position in the White House. Karl Rove should be put in jail for being an ass. That's, I mean, that, you know, just in general. I mean, I'm a broad stroke kind of guy. I can't get into the nuance and the esoteric nature of Wonksville all the time, but this guy is a dangerous, evil bastard that cares not about the working people of this country, only about exploiting their fears and desires for political gain. And now he says he's stepping aside. He should be thrown out. He should be arrested. When is that going to happen? When is the cops episode going to be taped at the White House? They can take them all out, screaming, "The bitch made me do it!" You know, I don't know which bitch that would be, but we can go right up the top. I mean, they should all be going down over this Plamegate case. But this is what they're doing. This is the big shakeup at the White House, is that Scott McClellan is resigning. Who cares? That guy, you know, they're all asses. All those press secretaries do the same job. The White House spokesman does the same job. It's just to misguide reporters, to stand strong for the denial and lies that the White House put him up to telling, and stand there. But he was, they're all sort of have a sad lack of personality, and this guy, I think, should just go. I think he's probably happy. Maybe he can finally come out of the closet and live the life that he wants to live and speak his mind and as hard as he wanted to speak it. But I'm glad he's out of there. I don't know what the hell they plan to put in his place. But he was one of the great lying asses of our century. And the Rove thing, I don't know what it really means. He says he's going to focus on regional elections, on maintaining the House Republican rule, and in the Senate as well. So he's going to be helping with local campaigns, which frightens me. He would have done it anyways. And I guarantee you he's only, you know, one cell phone call away, one BlackBerry text message away from the president at any given point in time. I think he's got a presidential pager on his implanted in his brain. I think him and Bush have a symbiotic relationship that he's probably detaching himself from because Bush has taken the whole relationship down. That codependency isn't working out anymore. But the fact that Rove is going to spend more time focusing on local elections and statewide elections is frightening to me. You can always already see the manifestations of that, the machinations of that with some of the anti-democratic ads, Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado, blaming the Democrats for the parts of the immigration law that that say that immigration and illegal immigrants are felons. They're already starting to do that to smear the Democrats with this crap. And that's completely Rovian, and I hope remains ineffective. But not unlike George Lakoff said, George Lakoff, what a rough name to go through, about framing in his big book, Moral Politics, or Don't Call It an Elephant. What is it called? You're not choosing an elephant. You're not. Oh, see, now I can't even hold the frame of his book about frames. The negative frame thing is that once you put it in people's heads that the Democrats are guilty of something, if those people are narrow-minded and don't like Democrats anyways, even if that frame is retracted, like even if you were to prove that the Democrats had nothing to do with making felons out of illegal immigrants, that this was a Republican bit of legislation, once that frame is in the head, that's the thing that sticks. The retraction never sticks. That's why it's always on the second or the last page.
All I know is that there are going to be a lot of Democratic candidates who find out they have illegitimate black children.
Yeah, I mean, if they can use that one again. I think that the
works every time, man.
Sure it does. It distracts people, and even if it's not true, even if it's not true. They used that one on McCain in so many words, and even though it wasn't true, the frame sticks, and people judge them based on that. Even they go, it's a lie, but that guy's kind of shady anyways because they said that about him. It's got nothing to do with judging the guy for reals. Also, oil prices soaring up. In the paper, it's interesting how they say that supply constraints, it's because of Iraq, it's because of Nigeria, it's because of the Gulf of Mexico, it's because of all these other problems other than just good old American price gouging on behalf of oil companies. That's what it's about. And how do we start wrapping our brain around alternative energy resources? We're going to talk to Kevin Phillips about that because a good deal of his book is about re-gauging, rethinking how the energy infrastructure works on a global basis. Also, it's a pretty monumental task he's done in bringing those three elements together, theocrats, religious fanaticism, oil, and national debt, into explaining the kind of forecast of what would be, you know, what is a cultural and political Armageddon that we're heading towards. Also, here in front of me, congratulations to Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes. Who knew the Antichrist was a girl? And apparently it is a girl that they had. Her name is Suri, which, you know, is, well, you know, maybe I'd talk about it in the jokes in just a minute. But they do this, it's a silent procedure, this silent birthing. Do you know about this from
Scientology? Oh, yeah. I learned all about that.
You researched it?
I was silent birthed myself.
But it's an interesting concept, the way that these guys apply the ideas of, behavioral conditioning, that they don't buy psychology, but they sort of buy certain elements of behavioralism, clearly. The Scientologists believe that words spoken during times of pain are recorded by the reactive mind and can cause potential problems for both mother and child. So
suppress it.
Well, suppress it or don't engage. No, I think what they're saying is that if anything is said during the birthing process, that is going to go into the mental computer and stay there and lodge in there and cause an emotional or spiritual malignancy. Like my mother, apparently right when I was born, the first thing she says was, crap, it's a boy. And I think that might have had some bearing on my emotional well-being and my sense of security. I don't know. My mother also told me constantly that I was an accident. How does that help anything? So maybe this silent birthing thing is not such a bad idea. But you might want to say, I love you. Welcome to the world. Quit crying. Jesus, why is it crying so much? Jesus, well, shut it up. You know, something like that. No?
Maybe a silent life, you know? Yeah, if that rule applies to birth, it should be the whole life. People just shut up and not say anything.
Yeah, you know what? My brother went on a silent retreat. He said it was the best thing he ever did. Listen, every week we reflect on our times of, what am I saying? That's the beginning of a joke. A lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure you're up to speed and informed. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show's Short Order News. Every week we reflect on our time. Oh, what is that? I'm doing it twice. Where's the rest of it? I'm just reading stuff in front of me. That's the intro to the next bit. A sex expert at the retrial of a German cannibal jailed for killing a man and feeding on his flesh says the defendant was motivated by his victim's wish to be eaten. One guy wanted to be eaten, another guy wanted to eat him. They met online. Make eHarmony work for you. Tom Cruise, here we go, and Katie Holmes, the public lovebirds, dubbed Tomcat by the media, had a baby girl on Tuesday. The girl was named Suri. Her name has its origins in Hebrew, meaning princess, or in Scientology, meaning cash cow. Scott McClellan, as I mentioned before, the calm voice of an embattled White House throughout the most tumultuous times of the Bush administration, announced today that he will step down as press secretary to President Bush. You can see his resume on Washington, D.C.'s Craigslist. The headline is available. Available, conduit of lies, must get benefits, will not work weekends. And that's the Mark Maron Mark Maron Show Short Order News for tonight. I'm a babbling idiot with too many pieces of paper in front of me. Going to read the Short Order News opening, then reading the introduction for the bit that's coming up, which is hopefully Mort Mortensen.
Very informed. You look like, you know, like a Dickensian type image here.
So weird you bring that up, because I just had a phone conversation with a friend of mine, Dave Stebbins, down in Florida, about Dickens, talking about Dickens.
Really?
And how huge Dickens was and what a huge success and star he was, and how he was pathologically obsessed with an 18-year-old girl that he could not get to sleep with him, and it destroyed him. Coming up next.
And he was an anti-Semite.
Right, so then he deserved it. Mort Mortensen's more weekly remembrance, we're calling it now. Stick around.
Have you ever wondered what happened to the guy who invented light beer? Well, he's dead. That's Mort Mortensen's weekly remembrance coming up next. Now, remember, Crestor is not for everyone. Mark Maron.
Don't think of an elephant, Jim. Don't think of one. Don't think of an elephant. Can you see? Like, that's the whole idea, is that if you say that, how can you not think of one? Because it's already in there, so the frame sticks. You dig? That's the name of the book. That's all I'm saying to
you.
Like
when you're at a funeral, whatever you do, don't laugh.
Don't laugh. But that's a little different, I guess, isn't it? Because you can't not think of an elephant without first thinking of an elephant, positing it in your consciousness.
Man, you get way too deep for me sometimes. I don't even know. Oh, man.
That's because you're afraid. You're afraid. Every week we reflect on our times of sorrow as we look back on the lives of the recently departed. Here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance. You're all right?
Hey,
how you doing, Morgan?
All right, man.
Is everything okay? I feel like I haven't seen you in a while.
It's been a while. It's been about a week and a half or so.
You all right?
I had to collect my thoughts.
Spring.
Get
allergies.
My life together.
Oh, okay.
Think of things.
Yeah.
Think of the future. Helen Ulrich, nutritionist. Helen Ulrich, the celebrated nutritionist who popularized the food pyramid and promoted nutritional labels, died this month of shock after learning she was manufactured in a place that handles nuts.
What? Yeah. All right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
By pushing for nutritional information labels and promoting the food pyramid, Mark, Ulrich made it easier for Americans to understand what they were eating, and in the process, stuffed themselves with the kind of crap that makes this country the stupidest, fattest place on earth.
Uh-huh.
Ulrich.
You all right? You need it?
Oh, gosh. The carpet in here is just full of allergens.
Yeah.
Ulrich introduced the food pyramid in 1988 after rejecting such earlier prototypes as the cheese ziggurat, the tripe tent, and the quasi-regular dodecahedron of pork. That was a mouthful.
It was, man, but she was a thinker, apparently.
Apparently, yeah. Oh, man, it's passing sad path.
Yeah,
Ulrich requested her remains be packaged with all her ingredients clearly marked on the casket.
That's sad. Food pyramid.
Food pyramid.
It's hard to eat all a member of each one, you know? All right, go ahead.
It's very complicated.
I'm going to take up too much time.
Michael S. Joyce, conservative. Michael Joyce, who is president of the Bradley Foundation, played a central role in the rise of neoconservatism during the 1990s, died of happiness last month after achieving his lifelong goal of watching America spiral through the bottom of a toilet into the cesspool of history.
I didn't mean to laugh, sorry.
I know you're laughing because it's just to release tension.
Yeah.
In the 1990s, his reform movement threw thousands of Wisconsin residents off welfare rolls, forcing them to sleep in parks huddled together for warmth in their giant novelty cheesehead hats.
You all right?
Something in my eye.
Okay. Okay.
In 2001, at the behest of Karl Rove, Joyce created Americans for Community and Faith-Centered Enterprise. This led to other successful spin-off organizations like Christian First, Jew Last, Eat the Poor, and That Sore on Your Penis is Because You're Black. That is a very popular one. Over the years, Joyce's foundation has given away over $280 million in the fight to allow school vouchers for religious schools, an effort that has kept thousands of innocent children from ever having to undergo the trauma of reading the Constitution.
Mm.
Ooh, that was deep.
Yeah, it was. All right.
Joyce requested his body be laid out on a dining room table and fondled by local Teamsters. Let's face it, everybody's got their kinky side.
Wow.
This has been this week's weekly remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, goose chopping onions.
You all right? I feel like we rush the end of it, because usually at the end of these things, what's going to happen to his remains? What's going to happen to Joyce's remains, Michael S. Joyce?
Well, he's going to be fondled by the local Teamsters. He also requested that the remains be dried, pressed into an anti-abortion leaflet, and tossed it out into local kindergartens.
Oh, see? Yeah, you must have been so consumed with being upset that...
I know. Yeah, sometimes you're overwhelmed with emotion.
I'm glad the medicine is working for you, because I don't see you with the Kleenexes anymore. I miss that, but I'm glad that it's working for you.
Well, you got this combination antihistamine and antidepressant.
Oh, okay. Well, good for you.
Working really well.
Massimo Calabrese from Time Magazine to talk about the 10 best senators and a few of the bad ones after this. Stay with us. It's the Mark Maron Show.
Now he's developed the glue from bacteria. Mark Maron.
Giving away all the secrets. Welcome back to the show. It's a Mark Maron show. You can go to markmaron.com, MARCMARON, and blog the night away with some of our other friends. Just got a letter from one of our buddies in Austin, Texas, who met Russ Feingold last night.
Really?
Yeah, and he's a big fan of Russ Feingold. This is Blake in Austin. Huge, goes back, Morning's Edition fan, also a Mark Maron show fan. But he says, I went to a fundraiser here in Austin last night and met Russ Feingold, and I'm happy to report that I'm still enthusiastically supporting him for president in 2008. His speech was certainly more fiery than you would hear on Meet the Press or Charlie Rose, so that part was definitely fun. One thing I was curious about, I don't know if you've met him in person or not, was my impression of him in person was going, I didn't know what it was going to be, is basically what he's saying. I already knew I liked the television version, if you know what I mean. So here's my summation. I don't want this to sound negative because it probably will come off that way. If you were to point out Russ Feingold to me, and I had no idea who he was just by looking at him, I would guess he was a golf pro. Not a professional golfer, but a golf pro. Take that how you want. So, average guy, but great senator, and one, I might add, didn't make the list we're about to talk to this our next guest about, and he'll tell us why. Time Magazine writers Massimo Calabrese and Perry Bacon have a piece in the next Time listing the 10 best senators and about 5 of the worst. Obviously, we're a fairly partisan operation here, but I'm curious to know how senators of both parties are judged by some of the historians and former senators they talked to during their research. So joining us on the phone now is Massimo Calabrese. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'm glad you're here because, you know, I'm not a huge wonk, and sometimes I don't always know what makes people good or bad legislatures unless they're corrupt and I just get a bad feeling about them. So what were some of the how did you judge these guys on your list?
Well, the thing is, the Senate's a peculiar place.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed originally to be cumbersome and difficult and kind of a break on big swings in public opinion and sudden surges in executive power.
They were there to protect the president from regular people.
quite the opposite. And in fact, you know, even now at a time of expanding executive powers, the place does act as kind of a restraint just in its nature, even if I know a lot of your viewers, your listeners probably think that it hasn't restrained the president as much as they would like. Even just in the structure of it, it slows things down. But that also means that it's difficult for senators to get anything done that's good, to move anything forward. So a lot of what we were looking for in choosing these senators was whether or not they can be effective and make a difference. And regardless of ideology, we looked for people who were effective.
Now, it's true that the difference between the Senate and the House is essentially that the House were sort of the rabble. They were the working class on a certain level, and they were state representatives, where the Senate, I think, historically were, you know, from a wealthier class, usually landowners, and were there to be a filter, right?
Sure. I mean, in comparison to the European systems where the upper houses landed gentry and so forth, there was some echo of that. But as it turned out, the structures of the place ended up with the House being much more monolithic because the rules of the House make it so the leadership controls everything and the minority party can't do anything. And even individuals in the leadership party can't do anything without the say-so of leadership. Whereas in the Senate, you know, Bill Frist, nobody really cares what he says or does for the most part. The Republicans, McCain, Hagel, whoever, do whatever they want. So it's a much more kind of individual-centric place, but that also means you have to be able to work with the other individuals to get them to do what
right.
you want.
Right. So let me just read the list of the good guys, the best senators you picked, and then we'll start with the Democrats because we might run out of time.
Sure.
Tad Cochran, a Republican from Mississippi. Kent Conrad, Democrat, North Dakota. Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois. Ted Kennedy, Democrat, Massachusetts. John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, who's up for re-election. Carl Levin, Democrat, Michigan. Dick Lugar, Republican, Indiana, who's also up for re-election. John McCain, Republican, Arizona. Olympia Snowe, Republican from Maine, also up for re-election. Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania. Now let's just go from the top there. Kent Conrad, why do you make your list?
It's a funny thing. Of all the people on that list, he's probably the least well-known, but talking to people up on the Hill,
mm-hmm.
he, more than any other name from current senators, he was the one whom people mentioned. People really respect his expertise. He took the advice that freshman senators get, which is go and master a single subject, and he's done it with a vengeance on, you know, that big casino item, raising and spending money. He's the master of the budget up there, and he does it oftentimes, you know, using charts. But that's just one of the ways that he sort of takes very, very complicated budget issues and boils them down. And he makes very, very powerful arguments and is very, very effective at winning people over in a way that a lot of times, you know, straight argument can't do it, but he's very good at it.
Okay, Dick Durbin, who's been very outspoken lately on issues of privacy and immigration, how about him?
We put him in for his debating skills. One of the examples recently, the Judiciary Committee markup, when they put out the big immigration compromise a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
the first thing out of the box that happened at that sort of open public hearing on the compromise immigration bill was a big debate between John Kyle, very, very conservative, who's also on our list, and Dick Durbin. And, you know, they're both very, very smart, and Durbin just a classic debater and basically won the whole committee over, or virtually the whole committee over, on the need to not impose penalties on people who give humanitarian aid to illegal immigrants. It really was the force of argument. And it's rare that you see that these days in the Senate because a lot of times people just get up and bloviate. He's really a good debater.
Yeah, I don't know how to debate. Do you?
You know, I don't. I guess people take it in high school. I never did much.
Yeah, I wish I did. It usually just digresses and gets personal, and I storm off. Which I don't think happens that much in the Senate, but occasionally.
They try to be polite, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Ted Kennedy, you have to like Ted Kennedy because it's just a rule, right? He's never going to leave. He's going to be there forever, and he does good things.
It's funny about him because, you know, a lot of the anger that we've gotten in the blogosphere over this list is centered on Kennedy, and it always portrays him as this liberal icon. But the thing about him is he has amassed a huge record of legislation, not because he's this, you know, stand firm left winger, but because he's willing always to sort of shave it off a little bit to see what kind of deal he can get. And, you know, the result is something that's much less than Democrats in general and liberals in particular would like, but something that makes a big difference, like the Civil Rights Act in 91 or any number of education bills or other things. He's just got a huge record of legislation under his belt.
And Carl Levin, who I respect, and we've had conversations with before, who was a big part. He was a 9/11 commission, wasn't he? Or 9/11. He did a lot of he's just been very outspoken in pursuing some sort of justice with this administration.
Yeah, he did. Well, he's been very tough on the administration on Iraq as a ranking minority on armed services. He did do a lot of stuff bringing up the family members of 9/11.
Yeah, that was it.
Start shining a spotlight on that. And he's just, you know, he's a smart, hardworking guy that basically, you know, in a time when the Senate isn't doing as much oversight as it might, he's holding up that end of things.
Now let's talk about bad legislators. You know, I'm not. You know, we can talk about the Republicans in a minute, but in terms of, like, from where I stand, I don't know why Feingold didn't make the best senator list. Why would that be?
Well, I'll tell you honestly, a couple of people who we talked with did mention him, and he falls. You know, if the overriding idea is, you know, can they make a difference? He certainly does. McCain-Feingold was a big one. He falls into the category of people who are sort of contrarian, out there on their own, stand up and say what they believe regardless of what the institution may want. We've got a couple of people who fit that category already, so he didn't quite shine the way some of the others did.
Well, it's just interesting to me. Our guest is Massimo Calabresi from Time Magazine, and John McCain, who, you know, in terms of what I think a bad senator is, a bad senator is somebody, you know, who is corrupt or shamelessly prostitutes themselves out to big business for their own ends, as opposed to the ends of their state or their constituents, or breaks the law. But McCain is a fairly controversial figure because he was seen as a maverick, but now he's selling himself out to align himself for a presidential run, and I find that kind of negative.
Well, there's obviously a lot of attention being paid to that at the moment, and it's it is a political move he's making, no question about it. One can't say that he's abandoned his ways of shining spotlights on issues that wouldn't otherwise get a lot of attention, because he's still out there doing that to a certain extent. He did it with Abramoff. He was absolutely the person shining the light on lobbying excess more than anybody else in the Senate, especially from a very backwater committee, Indian Affairs, that you never hear from.
Right.
He's got other things on the agenda, even as he's pandering, as you might say, to the right. He's got these other things that he's pursuing, gerrymandering and things like that. So
yeah.
We certainly didn't find it the case that he sort of flipped entirely. I should also say, in the way of compromising one's principles, that was somewhat the point we were making with Kennedy, that, you know, it's fine to believe in something, but if you just believe in it and refuse to do any business at all up there, after all, you got to be able to compromise with people who have different views if you're going to get anything done. And some of the people we put on the worst list, both on the left and the right, were the people who saw it as their responsibility or right to be completely unwilling to compromise, and so in the end never got anything done, help anybody. That's a Mark Dayton right there.
Right. It comes down to their ability to legislate. Now, but Conrad,
or to decide where it's okay to compromise in order to get something else.
What about Conrad Burns? Now, he's a pretty bad guy.
He was somebody who inevitably was on everybody's list
of
worst senators. He's been there a long time, should have gotten a lot done, didn't, but is, you know, more to the point, very much under investigation by the Justice Department and this broader task force for his involvement with Jack Abramoff.
Yeah.
He's in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and that's corruption. And before we split, Jim Bunning from Kentucky. What makes him bad?
Well, he's an angry man, and in the category of people who can't find a way to get along with other people, even in his own party, he's the exemplar of that.
All right. Well, Massimo Calabrese from Time Magazine, thank you for sharing your time with us. We'll send people to the article online and pick the magazine up.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right, you take it easy.
You too.
Bye-bye. The other people on that list, the bad ones, Daniel Akaka, Democrat from Hawaii, Wayne Allard, Republican from Colorado, Mark Dayton, Democrat from Minnesota. But you know who you like and who you don't like and why. We'll be back in moments, and we're going to have Kevin Phillips, American Theocracy, in a little while.
And now back to the voice of Blinky, the GE light bulb, Mark Maron.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim Earl. Man, I'll tell you, yesterday I made a big mistake, though it went unnoticed. How often does that happen in one's life? I did not wish my wife a happy birthday on the air. It was her birthday.
I was thinking about that as we left the studio.
Yeah, that that I was in trouble. That I was in deep. But fortunately, my wife doesn't listen to the show. She does occasionally. I listened to the show last night. I listened to our show last night.
I listened to part of it, yeah.
And what, you had to turn it off? What's the matter? You don't like it? What happened?
Excuse me for having sex every once in a while.
Oh, good for you. I can't even picture that. But I can a little bit. I actually.
I know you can picture it.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the major ways that, okay, this has gone too far.
It has, right? It could have gotten a little touchy there in a second. Good. No, I try not to picture you and Heather having sex, if that's okay. If that's all right. Okay?
Yeah, that's fine with me. In fact, I'd prefer it that way.
Yeah, I bet you would keep that out of my head, because who knows where that'll lead. You know, next thing you know, I'm in there with you, and then it's awkward. Am I right? Am I right? Would that be awkward, or maybe not?
I don't think it'd be awkward. It'd be inappropriate.
Would it be inappropriate? But, like, let's say if I just showed up, like if my wife and I showed up, and you and Heather were having sex, and we were just like, hey, what's going on? You want to swing? How would you feel about that?
I'd say, it must be Tuesday.
Yeah, that's right. So,
man.
Thanks again for that last night. Had a great time. That was great.
Oh, my God. Yeah, anyway, you were listening to the show last night.
Oh, see, try to switch subjects. Hey.
I'm taking it back to the beginning.
Oh, no, I wishing my wife happy birthday. Last night, I was in the show. We went to see the film Water. Deepa, oh, man, I will tell you right now, she's going to be on the show tomorrow. Deepa Mehta, she directed it. It is a profoundly beautiful and sad movie about widows in India who are confined to these ashrams. This was in the 30s, but apparently in this religion, in the Hindu religion, if I'm not mistaken, this a lot of stuff I don't understand. It's one of those films that you watch and you see something horrible that is done because of religion and because of the way a government is structured and because of traditions that are obviously dangerous. And I'm like, man, there's so much I don't understand or know about. I need to do some research. There's this tradition in the Hindu religion where people who are widowed, they can't marry again, and they have to honor their husbands even in their husband's death, and they cannot they're shunned in society and kept in these ashrams, and many of them are forced into prostitution, and it was a movie about it took place in 1938 when Gandhi was sort of coming to rise and some of the more traditional religious laws were starting to shift, and it's a story about a young girl and it's a story about several women. In this, I guess would be the version of a, not even a convent, but a widow's house. It was painful, but beautiful. Indian film, India in and of itself is beautiful. I would love to go there, but I understand so little of it. And I've been in this situation before where I love their food. And that's really the most of that I know about it. I know about Pakistan and India and the problems there. But in terms of the way India is set up, in terms of the class system and the religions and everything else, it just looks like when you see films of it or I see pictures that there's a million different offshoots of a couple of different kinds of religions. Everybody's always involved in some sort of – when they're not doing outsourced jobs, they're doing some sort of religious ritual – And there's all
it's
kinds
a huge
of
place.
Religious icons. I mean, I know I'm generalizing, and I feel like I'm being bordering on racist, but I'm fascinated with Indian culture, and I'd love to spend time there because I think it's beautiful. But that's what I did with my wife last night on her birthday. It was like a 2.5-hour movie, and I can't wait to talk to the director tomorrow. I think it'll be interesting because apparently it still exists. There's like 30 million of these women that still exist in India now, and it continues to happen. It was devastating, but
well, being a widow in general is kind of like, even in Western culture up until modern times, pretty much outcast you in a way. I mean, you were expected to walk around in black
and grieve forever
for about a year or two or three,
and honor the death of your husband by not getting involved too quickly or being judged. That is definitely true. Tomorrow we also have the guys from the Daily Kos. I think Marcos Molitzas Zuniga, Marcos from the Daily Kos, is going to come in. He might come in with his writing partner, Armstrong. They've got a book called Crashing the Gate, Net Roots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. That'll be interesting to talk to him because that's something I've always poo-pooed initially. I just thought that taking political action requires more than just forwarding email, but I imagine it's much broader, and it seems like it's been much more effective than I ever imagined would be. But who the hell am I? If you watch my HBO special, I thought the internet was a bust. I thought it was going to be like CB radios. Boy, what an idiot I turned out to be. Hey, they can't all be gems. It's tough being a visionary.
It's so rare kind of a bust, though.
I don't know if it is a bust, Jim.
Yeah, you got Google, Yahoo, and every major, and Microsoft. Being complicit in human rights violations in China, I mean, that's a bust to me. That's a whole nother show, man.
I understand what you're saying. You mean in terms of censorship and in terms of not honoring...
It's millions of people not knowing what Tiananmen Square was about in China.
You mean being colluding with the communist government? Yeah, because it's a market. Yeah, that's pretty bad. But can you imagine a day without the internet? Can you really imagine that? It's so weird how quickly human beings adapt to stuff. Like, once you cross a line, you can't see your life without it. Even with a cell phone, I don't know how we managed. And it doesn't make anything more convenient. I mean, just because we have Google and I can answer any question I ever am curious about within seconds if it's not philosophical.
It takes up more of your time.
It eats your time. It eats, yeah.
Computers take up more of your time.
They take more of your time, and I don't know if it's helped on that level. I think we've emptied our brains to a certain degree. It's made me lazy.
I remember researching a paper in high school or college and going to the library.
Now you can just buy the paper online. You don't even have to research it. You can have someone else write it for you. A machine will write a completely unique paper.
I still do that. I still have, high school kids write my papers.
All right, so I'm getting nervous. So I'm going to talk to Kevin Phillips in a second. The guy's written a great book. I'm in awe of it. Smart guy. We're going to learn some stuff.
Tell him that.
About the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade. He's not on the phone yet. And there's no way he can listen right now. All right, so I'm not going to tell him that. All right, we'll be back in a second with Kevin Phillips.
Now, he is not a trained medical practitioner, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim Earle.
Hey.
Thanks for being here, people. Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, welcome to the Mark Maron Show if you're just tuning in. I have been talking about the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade for the last 2 years. Apparently, they have been evolving for the last 200 years. Theocratic movements in this country, along with imperial ambitions based on the consolidation of global oil resources and amassing great debt and pursuing those ambitions, could be the overreaching that ends America as we know it. It is scary to think that in a matter of a few years, this could be an isolationist country run by a Christian dictator with cars that are fueled by the melted flesh and crushed bones of heathens, my friends. Of course, I'm exaggerating. Ex-Republican strategist and an outspoken critic of the Bush administration, Kevin Phillips, has written one of the most well-researched and informed books on this subject with American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money. Welcome to the show, Kevin Phillips.
Nice to be here.
So now, how close are we to theocracy, really, really speaking?
Well, it's an interesting question, and let me explain why. If you go back and you look at any true historical theocracy, it was generally speaking pretty small and often emerged out of a migration of diehard true believers, so it created a context that wasn't too easy to duplicate. In a country the size of the United States, 300 million people, and a leading global role, you're not going to repeat the same thing.
Right.
But what I would single out as just a quick laundry list of the reasons to be very concerned at the American, much lesser version of it developing would be as follows. The Republicans, once they took over the South, got a strong admixture of some of the most intense religion in the United States. It really bucked up their count of religious people in the party. The Democrats became more secular.
Uh-huh.
The Republicans became almost a religious party. The theory comes from John Green, an Ohio political scientist, who was pointing out by 1988 that the correlation was growing higher and higher between frequent church going and Republican voting.
Right.
By the time we got into the early 21st century, that even included Orthodox Jews, who were much more Republican than any other Jew.
That was because of the values issue?
It's theology.
Just theology in general. Just bottom line, that do you think that some of the people that are in office truly believe we are living in end times and they are actively trying to make it happen?
Well, I think they truly believe we may be, yes. I think it's important to stress here that it is theology as opposed to values. The whole value stuff was, it's much more general, and it doesn't necessarily bespeak religion.
It's about Israel.
No. I mean, there are lots of values that people could have in terms of neighborhood schools and so forth, and neighborhoods and lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're dealing with theology, you're starting to get the real force that's troublesome. And that's what we've seen come in. Now, besides that aspect of the Republicans, you've got the whole new set of developments that occurred really in the last 6 or 8 years. And one of the things that reinforced the Republican religiosity was the way they picked up still more people in the South who were heavy religious churchgoers because of the Clinton impeachment. It wasn't a national phenomenon, but within that region, it really worked against the Democrats. You get 9/11 comes into play. George W. has always had a big religious streak, sees himself as some kind of messiah. After 9/11, he not only, I think, saw himself that way, but the religious right, where the people that lead it in Washington were sampled by the Washington Post, and the reporter came up with a fascinating conclusion that the people that he sampled, the leaders, said that George W. Bush had replaced Pat Robertson as the leader of the religious right now. The president of the United States had never before ever been thought of in that way.
Our guest is Kevin Phillips. The book is American Theocracy. Now, I guess my question to you as somebody who is deeply familiar with Republican strategy is that, do you think that Republicans in general, old school conservatives, fiscal conservatives, think that this pandering to the religious right over the last few years, and that this is some sort of backlash? That it seems a little out of control to me that this is not part of the plan, this theocracy, is it?
No, I think it is a little out of control. And the other stuff you can toss into the hat is the whole troublesome interface between science and faith, whether it be Shivo down in Florida, or the stem cell research, or the question of when conception begins, and many, many things like this. So that what you're seeing, which I think the Bushies didn't bargain for, is the emergence within the non-evangelical Protestants, who were the long-standing mainstay of the Republican Party, a distaste for all of this.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that's become significant. Even Kerry, who I think was an appalling campaigner, made some gains with those people. And I think this is one that's ready to burst out.
Okay, let's talk about some of the other parts of your book. In terms of, in the book, you explore imperial political models that were based on energy resources. You talk about whale oil in Holland, I believe, and coal in Britain. And both of these imperialist nations broke down when the infrastructure supporting the industries stopped functioning as the market expanding research resources diminished. Now, you talk about peak oil, and that there's a real good chance that we've hit peak oil in a lot of our global oil resources. Now, what happens now if we don't redesign our infrastructure?
Well, I think what will happen is that the idiosyncratic nature of the previous major energy regimes, the Dutch with wind and water and the British with coal, suggests that you really have your moment in the sun, energy-wise, with the one thing that's idiosyncratic to you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to lose that, whether you run out of it or the global energy regime changes, you're generally out of luck. And my sense is that we're going to be out of luck when the global energy regime goes off oil. And that can happen in several ways. First, our production peaked back in the early 1970s. It may be that global production is within 10 or 15 years of peaking. If so, that's going to mean a huge crisis. There's no real alternative for industry for quite a while. The United States would lose control of oil. It would be spending probably $400 or $500 billion a year to import the two-thirds or three-quarters of the oil that has to come from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
You'd no longer have oil supporting the dollar, which it has since the 1970s. And you'd have the United States obliged to spend huge amounts of money, it already does, on turning the military into partially an oil protection service.
Right.
So I don't think we can afford this. And I think if it does happen, if the United States slips in terms of the whole oil yardstick, we lose the infrastructure with which we built the United States in terms of energy. You have a population dispersed all over the country in a way that's very wasteful of energy.
Yep.
Large houses, all these things, if the tide turns, the whole American lifestyle is at risk.
So now, okay, now I'm not an economist. I barely understand how it works, to be honest with you. I have a hard time wrapping my brain around the amount of debt the country is in, and we're spending $10 billion a month about on the war alone. And we are. How does the debt play out? Are we now owned by China?
Well, you can't say we're owned by China, but you can say the debt plays out in a very, very critical way. And how badly the results come in over the next 5 or 10 years will be about as crucial as the whole oil situation.
Yep.
Essentially, what's happened in the last 40 years is the United States, since Vietnam, has gone more and more into debt. It started with budget deficits, then it became the international debt. Then, after 9/11, you had this whole fear on the part of Washington that the economy had to be stimulated, so interest rates were dropped to practically nothing,
right,
and people were told, consolidate your credit cards, borrow more money, refinance your house, and the total of private debt has skyrocketed, literally skyrocketed. People now see interest rates going up. The question is whether the housing bubble is popping or whether it's even popped already.
Yep.
And whether people can handle their credit card debt in the recession that's probably likely in the next year or
wow.
two.
And now you can't, the bankruptcy reform, people can't really file for personal bankruptcy without a tremendous amount of trouble. I don't know what's going to happen to all these people. Can you tell me, as a historian and as an analyst, you know, what needs to happen? And actually, if you could just stay with us over one break and tell me in a minute, can you do that?
Sure.
Kevin Phillips, we're talking to Kevin Phillips. American Theocracy is the book. It's a great book, and we're going to hopefully, you know, talk about some solutions here in just a second, so stay with us.
Now his oil production has peaked. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest on the phone is Kevin Phillips, the author of American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. So I guess it seems to me if we use Iraq as an example of all the negative trends you talk about in your book and play that out, it seems like all of them are sort of coming to head there in a way. And I don't know how that's going to play out. And I certainly don't know what some of the solutions are to some of the problems that you're talking about, not only on infrastructure, but just in terms of legislation that this administration has put into play that could take years to reverse, that work against people in debt, certainly, and make it a lot more difficult for individuals to function in a world that is more run by corporations. What are some of the solutions that you see, Kevin Phillips?
Well, one of the things that happened is the new bankruptcy law basically means that people that wind up in debt and have to file for bankruptcy can't get discharged. They have to keep working for the people they owe money for. And that's been joked about as indentured servitude, and that joke doesn't ring true yet. But it might. It might if we have a severe recession and a lot of people are basically obliged to keep working to pay off their creditors. At a point in time when the value of their assets, houses, for example, might be starting to fall and jobs would be getting scarce, and we'd have to worry whether all the overseas people who hold governments, who hold American paper, are going to start to dump it.
What
so
happens
all
then?
Of this
what happens
can circle
if,
with great pain.
What happens if that happens? What if foreign governments dump our paper? What exactly happens?
Well, the dollar would decline, which would mean the cost of everything we import would rise sharply, whether it's oil or manufactured goods. I would assume that the purchasing power of the ordinary family would decline significantly. Jobs would probably shrink, too, because of the inability to pay for all the imports that companies would need.
Wow.
So probably you're looking at a pretty significant problem. Now, I think, frankly, that both parties are to blame for this. The Republicans more because of the last 5 years, but the Democrats because in the 1990s they were there when the American economy turned from being one that rested on manufacturing to be one that rested on finance.
Right.
And the flirtation with the financial sector is very bipartisan. And the inattention to the manufacturing sector is pretty strikingly bipartisan, too, for all the Democrats are probably the biggest supporters. So what we've seen happen is this movement of the United States into a money culture, which isn't just social and cultural, it's economic. That's where the money is made in the United States. I don't see how you buck this interest group. I don't see how we restore the America before all of these trends started to go way off the tracks in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
You don't see any way of bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States? It seems to me that with the culture of financial, basing the economy on that, that it's so much easier to lie. It seems that when your manufacturing is at home, you see the products with money. It's so corrupt.
I totally agree with you.
So do you see any way to bring back manufacturing in the global economy that we have? Is there any movement towards that, or do you think that's not a winning solution?
Well, it's probably not going to be a major solution because there's no way we get the jobs back when people have to be paid $12 or $14 in an hour to do what can be done in Southeast Asia for a buck and a half. Those jobs aren't coming back. But I think the notion of adding all these new upscale manufacturing jobs because of things having to do with high-value-added drugs and biotechnology and so forth. In the larger scale of thing, that's peanuts. The people are going to make money in the next century are the people that are building the industry and the cars and the mills in China and India.
So we don't get off on a so we don't end our interview with me thinking that it might honestly be the end times. Kevin Phillips, do you think that a change in the administration and that delivering a little more power back to the needs of the people will facilitate some movement in a positive direction?
Well, I think if the Republicans are tossed out because of what's been going on, there'll be some positive movement, but I think basically the Democrats are unable to overcome the entrenched elements in their party that are pretty similar to the Republicans in terms of the status quo.
So where should we move? Where are you moving?
Well, I'm not moving, but I just have my fingers crossed, and I keep my investment strategies very much in mind through the lens I've described.
Uh-huh. And I guess I should sell my house, because this doesn't sound very positive to me at all.
Well, we have to live in our houses, don't we? So we can't sell them.
You're saying, it seems to me that the way that religion is being used in the theocratic model is that some of these guys in Congress, like Sam Brownback in the Senate, are really gunning for a presidency, and that kind of religious infringement on our constitutional rights is a very possible thing, certainly in the desperate scenario that you're painting.
Well, I think it'll be unlikely that the religious right can maintain its momentum because of the steadily weakening popular view of the Bush administration. But if some further 9/11 equivalent were to come into play, I think they could rally around that and play the religious card again. If they stave off the Democrats in 2006, which I suppose is possible, they're going to get a chance to do those judicial appointments they really want, and that can move a lot of things, too. So the battle's far from over.
In terms of being a Republican strategist at one time in your life, what made you shift away from that?
Well, I don't care for what the Republican Party has become, but the Democrats have figured out over 20 years that I don't subscribe to what they represent either. And I don't feel terribly good about politics. And I joke to somebody that if it comes down to a choice between Hillary Clinton and somebody standing for the Bush faction in 2008, it's sort of like dynasties that they used to have in England with the War of the Roses, York and Lancaster.
Right.
You can't just deal with dynasties. You've got to have new blood and new ideas.
What do you think about someone like Russ Feingold?
Well, I think that the creative wing of the Democratic Party, the progressive wing, needs to have more of a flavor in any new government than the old hack sort of Bob Rubin and his interest groups,
right,
and all of that crowd.
Right.
But Feingold is not a likely messenger. I don't know who they have that would be a popular standard bearer that had those skills with some of those issues.
Al Gore? How about Gore? What if he comes back?
Al Gore. We've seen Al Gore. No more incarnations are necessary.
Oh, he did win the popular vote.
Oh, he did, but he had, I feel sorry for him because he had to run on Clinton's sort of scuzzy,
right,
personal record, which,
right,
I'm sure cost him enough votes to lose.
Right.
But he hasn't been an inspired fighter. He hasn't been much of a fighter at all.
All right. Well, you know, I guess we'll see what's going to happen, Kevin Phillips. I really appreciate the book, and I think everyone should read it. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay. The book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. We're going to talk to Andy Ostroy in a little while, and we've got some funny coming up, so hang around.
And now he was once deceived into a love affair with a robot. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. I have no idea where you're getting your information, but man, every one of them right on the money.
I know, man. I do my
right
research.
On the money.
Research.
Dude. Oh, no. I'm going to start the duding again. You know, I feel like I've unduded myself somehow or another. Have you noticed that?
Sure, bro.
Listen,
Brahim.
Brahim. I've unduded myself. I believe that I've deduded. Is it deduded or unduded? I've stopped the duding. Man, Kevin Phillips, I was really hoping he'd have some answers for me at the end of that. He's a smart guy. Obviously, I didn't like Clinton very much, but there are several Democrats that also thought he was sort of scuzzy.
Yeah.
But did not have much faith in Gore, did not have faith in Feingold. Certainly didn't like the Republicans, didn't think we were going to be able to turn the economy around. It sounded to me like after all was said and done, he's going to, you know, try to watch his investments and just ride this storm out for as long as he's got. Though the book is incredibly informative, I was hoping, I felt like the Armageddon was upon us by the end of that interview.
As long as we have the two-party system the way it is, you know, nothing's going to change. It's going to worse and worse and worse.
Well,
end of Rome.
Let's get Andy into this conversation. I've been reading the Ostroy Report for probably as long as it's been up there, I think it's over a year now. Andy Ostroy is an astute political observer, but more than that, he's just a guy who wanted to make a difference, and he started doing the blog. It's at OstroyReportBlogspot.com. He's got a public TV show, The Ostroy Delay Report, where Democrats play rough. It's in New York City. He wants, as he says, to kick some Republican ass. He's with us now. Hello, Andy Ostroy.
Hey, Mark.
How you doing, man?
All right. What's up, dude? Or can I not say that?
No, you can say dude all you want.
I
want
to do some dudification here tonight.
Let's dude it up, because I seem to have gotten rid of dude. I don't necessarily want it back, but dude, I got to say one thing. Today was a pretty big day politically with the pseudo shakeup of the inner sanctum there. McClellan's out. Rove has been limited or demoted, or how about just moved aside and put into another office? I mean, come on. Is that guy really going to be doing any less?
Well, it's like what Chuck Schumer says. It's just another example of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Oh, good. Well, that's good to hear. So it's definitely sinking, that ship. But doesn't it frighten you at all that Rove is going to put more time into focusing on local and state elections?
Well, you know, I'm a little suspect. I don't know how much is going to change with Mr. Rove. You know, it's funny. Somebody said today, with the changes occurring with Rove, does that mean Bush doesn't have any brain now? And, you know, I don't think Bush's brain is going anywhere. I think a lot of these moves are nothing more than window dressing, as Howard Dean said today. And, you know, the real issues are still there. The average person, you go on the street, ask them who Scott McClellan is, they don't know. I mean,
no.
You ever see Jay Leno when he goes on the street on Melrose Avenue?
Sure.
And ask people who the vice president is. They say Hillary Clinton.
But this is
a society that really is not very up on politics. So moving around Scott McClellan or Andy Carr, people like that, really doesn't change the perception that's out there on the
right.
street.
Right, and the bottom line is, politically, you know, all Bush is banking on now. Bush, I think, has accepted his position. If he hasn't, most of the other Republicans have. It's not just a lame duck, and somebody's probably not going to get his approval ratings above 40 again, but all he's doing and all he said he's going to do is commit to Rumsfeld and commit to the war for an extended period of time, because it's obvious to me with this whole Rumsfeld thing, who from what I understand today, Human Rights Watch is taking him to task legally for being involved in the Guantanamo Bay torture of the suspect at the 20th 9/11 hijacker. Mm-hmm. That apparently he was literally calling down there and saying, put me on speaker while you kick this guy. But I think it seems to me that Bush and him are just, committing to the long-term neocon plan of planting an embassy there that's fortressed and planting a base there that's fortressed until they can tap the spigot for eternity. And what do you think?
Well, here's the deal about Bush that I think. His presidency, his legacy is so inextricably tied to this war. He mm-hmm. has made this war the central theme of his campaign, and the history books years from now will judge him not on Social Security or anything else, but on this war. And many people can think this war is a disaster, and it is. But to come out publicly and kick Rumsfeld to the curb would be an admission that this is failure. Bush can't do that. He has to toe the line here and say this war is a success. We are making progress. This was my grand vision, like you said before, and Rumsfeld is my guy that's been carrying it out, and we've all been brilliant. And the reality is, these guys are out of touch with reality. Everyone else is looking at them, scratching their heads, saying, wait a second, this is more of like, Donnie, you're doing a heck of a job. And,
yeah.
And he has a tendency of taking people who are utter miserable failures in this administration and either giving them promotion or patting them on the back.
I think that, I honestly think, Andy Ostroy, and it's sad for me to think this in my heart, that I think Donald Rumsfeld thinks the war is going fine. I really think that all the deaths, the civilian deaths, the American deaths, the American injuries, the Civil War, is just part of the liability of taking such an insane sort of mission to push through what they want, an occupation, a permanent military occupation of the region. I really think that he's worked whatever it is that's going on there now into his bottom line, and with the support from the president, that he's just, it's fine with him and the neocons.
Well, what I find also most appalling in this whole Rumsfeld process is that, the Republicans have come out, the spin monkeys on TV and radio, they've come out, and, they're actually swift-boating these generals. I mean, you're talking about two generals who basically led the war for
right.
a couple of years. I mean, how do you do character assassination on these guys? I mean, it doesn't get any more high-ranking and involved than those two individuals. Well, and then you have other generals who, this is indicative of what I think the military is thinking overall. Just because only six or seven of them have spoken out doesn't mean that many of those other 7,000 that Rummy likes to cite, doesn't mean they're not sharing the same views.
That's right. And I think that I hope what you're saying in some respect is true, is that I hope the American public at least will catch wind of these are Rovian tactics, a swift voting idea, and these immigration ads that they're running in Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada, I believe.
I know, that's the craziest thing. I mean,
slandering
the amount of lying in Spanish. You know what I mean? It's like, these people have taken lying to new heights. They're like multilingual bullshit. Can I say that? I can't.
We're not live. It's okay.
BS artist. I'm sorry. Yeah. And, you bring up something really interesting. This bill that the House passed, the Sensenbrenner bill, this is a Republican-sponsored, Republican-passed bill. They're actually out there in Nevada, in Spanish, telling people that this is something that the Democrats have masterminded, and that it's the Democrats that have voted for this, and it's just out. I mean, it's reprehensible the level of lying that Karl Rove and company will go to
yeah.
to further their agenda.
Let me ask you a question, because
yep.
I heard Sam Cedar talking about this yesterday, and some people. Sam Cedar and some people are saying that the immigration legislation has backfired on the Republicans, and I think that it's I think it's going to be used as another way for Republicans who are running for midterms to distance themselves from the president, if need be, depending on the xenophobic makeup of their states or districts. I think that it hasn't, it was just served its purpose. I think that some of the guys who are running in more racist areas are able to say, this is our legislation, and the guys who aren't can just say, well, they think their way and I think mine. I think it was part of the plan. Do you?
Well, here's the problem with the Republicans is that they have brilliantly understood something that politicians for years have either neglected or have chosen not to delve into, and that is that if you lie and you lie often enough, like Mussolini and Hitler did back in the 30s and 20s, that you know this stuff is going to stick. So what they actually do is they just make stuff up.
Right.
And the case in point with the Spanish commercial out in Nevada is it illustrates the level of lying that they will go to, because what they have understood that a lot of other politicians and the Democrats certainly have not understood is that if you lie to people, they won't know the difference.
Exactly.
So they get their news from Jay Leno, and they get their news from other television shows. They don't read a paper, and if you tell them something, that's good enough for them.
Well,
and we don't want to go. You know, Democrats don't want to go there. They refuse to go there, and I kind of understand it. But this is war. That's why my show is we Democrats play rough, because this is war. You can't fight this battle, with your hands tied behind your back.
And I think you're right. And I think that some Democrats are stepping up. I still, despite what Kevin Phillips just said to me on the phone, saying that he thinks Gore is toast. I don't know. You were on this before anybody I saw out there in the blogosphere in terms of suspecting and hoping that Gore would run again. I think that he would be a good candidate. And
hopping on the Gore bandwagon, are you?
Well, I sort of have been, because I don't see anybody else. I think Feingold would be great. I don't know if he would be have the juice to make it a presidential run, but I think a Gore Feingold ticket would be great.
Here's my sense of you probably won't hear it anywhere else this same way, but to me the current crop of potential candidates in 2008 are literally a bunch of yawners.
Uh-huh.
If you look at who's running or who's about to run or who we suspect will run, Hillary Clinton. I think Chelsea Clinton probably has a better chance of becoming president.
I feel
president.
The same. Why does everybody think that she can be president? Why? I mean, it's not that I necessarily think she'd be a bad president, but why do people think she's electable?
Because they like Bill.
Okay, I guess.
And they don't realize she's not Bill.
What's his name?
Joe Biden just announced. He's the first guy. He's the early adapter. He came out and said he's going to run. But you know what? I've seen loofah sponges with more personality than Joe Biden. Joe Biden doesn't have a chance. You have a better chance of becoming president than Joe Biden.
And Biden's also got, I think he's got problems. I think he's been, turned out by the credit card industry. I think that he's got bigger issues. I kind of like Biden. Sometimes I like his honesty, but he's not that honest.
Well, he has no shot, And then you got Governor Warner, who is the new kid on the block in terms of
to see him work.
Boy Wonder, but
have you seen him work a room, that guy?
Sorry?
Have you seen him work a room? Have you seen him speak?
Supposedly he's brilliant.
Well, maybe that's the guy. We'll have to.
But you know what? I mean, my feeling, Mark, is if I want to vote for a pro-life, gun-toting religious zealot, I'll vote for Zell Miller. I mean, it's like, is this really what we as Democrats want? Is a guy who is sort of questioning the right of women to have abortion?
Is he really doing that?
Is that peace? I mean, this guy's carrying heat.
Well, the back in the peace thing is a debatable issue, but fighting against reproductive rights is just a no. That's a no winner from where I'm standing. If you can't at least honor progressive principles along those lines, what the hell good are you?
I mean, he likes NASCAR, for crying out loud.
Well,
that should make us run.
Yeah, I guess. I'm hesitant to judge racing enthusiasts. I'm more apt to judge people that want to restrict the access to a safe reproductive.
So the other candidates, Vilsack, Bay, Edwards. Al Gore. We got to remember what this man has accomplished.
He won.
This guy is a two-term senator.
Yeah.
He's a two-term congressman.
Yeah.
Two terms as vice president, presided over one of the most prosperous times in America's history. We were fairly at peace as a country. He was out there up front early about being anti-war.
Well,
obviously, his warnings about global warming.
That's it. Global warming,
environment, alternative fuel
standards
have been right out there, which are big issues today.
Yeah, big issues.
He won the popular vote. many believe, and he was robbed of the Electoral College by the Bush mob down in Florida and the
curiously
non-federalist Supreme Court.
We'll see if you're right.
He's got a shot here.
We'll see if you're right.
Anybody who doesn't think that is, I don't think, looking at it the right way.
We'll see if you're right, Andy, and then we'll take a bet, and I'll talk to you soon, man. So,
alrighty, Mark.
Thanks for being with us. The blog is osterreport.blogspot.com. If you're in New York, you can... What station's that show on?
Channel 67 on Time Warner Cable. Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m.
All right, right on, Andy. Take care of yourself.
You too, Mark. Bye-bye.
There you go. Man. All right. We'll be back with the Short Order News.
If you really believe Mark Maron is the one and true Christ, you won't want to miss his Short Order News coming up next. Amen.
And now he was once transformed into an intergalactic walrus. Mark Maron.
Yeah, I was. That was me. Look at this. Rumsfeld. I get this stuff from, dispatches from Truth Out. It's from a piece by a guy named Hader Rizvi. Rumsfeld could be criminally liable under federal or military law for the abuse and torture of detainee Mohammed al-Ghatani. Apparently, according to a statement released by Lieutenant General Randall Schmidt, it said that Rumsfeld was talking weekly with General Jeffrey Miller, a senior commando at Guantanamo prison there in 2003, early 2003, about this guy's interrogation. So this guy, that means that Rumsfeld... And this guy was thought to be, you know, the missing hijacker, the 20th hijacker in the 9/11 thing. That Rumsfeld was literally on the phone with the guy who was torturing the guy at Gitmo, saying, "What are you doing to him now? Oh, yeah, you got him strung up? Yeah? What are you doing? You hitting him?" But let me hear it. He was that intimately involved. And these are people that were willing to dismiss that there were systemic problems when it comes to torture.
Democracy is not a pretty thing. It's messy. It's a messy business.
The beginning, in its early stages, yeah, it's messy, that democracy.
We're still in the early stage of democracy. You know what? The Republic lasted 600-700 years.
So now what's going on, Jim?
Look what happened to that.
Yeah. What's going on, man?
So, and it ended with a big Caligula party.
But that party's been going on. That party goes on every day in this country, the Caligula party. That's part of our culture. That's what fuels consumer America, is the Caligula party. Just never-ending sex and food and fat.
Your Easter party was the same way. You had big bowls of stuff with made out of hummingbird tongues.
Yeah. That was hard to... Because I killed all those hummingbirds myself, too. You know how much time that took? I had to get both of my cats underneath that hummingbird theater, grabbing those hummingbirds, throwing them to the ground. Then I got to pull the tongue out. And you saw how much we ate, and most of it we threw away. You know, that was the sad part, is that there was like 600-700 hummingbirds went into that damn dip, and most of you just threw away because no one ate it.
You didn't. You not only did not just throw it away, you threw it at people.
You're laughing. Laughing.
That's how wasteful you are.
Throwing away a big bowl of hummingbird tongue dip, going, ha, 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 who cares? Who cares?
So where are you going to go when the whole thing just goes down the crapper?
I would like to go. I think I had a great time in Tuscany. In Umbria, I think is beautiful. Wouldn't mind going there. Mm. I actually would probably end up in the Pacific Northwest. That's where I would stay in the country. I'm not an expat at heart. I
paramilitary groups up there in Tuscany.
Not in Idaho. I'm not going to Idaho.
Mussolini freaks again.
No, I don't. You don't have to deal with those people. I never had expatriate fantasies. I'm not somebody who ever really thought like I'm getting out of this country. I love this country. I love a lot of parts of it. And if I moved, really honestly, I would move up to Oregon. Or Seattle area. Pacific Northwest for me is just beautiful. So let's do this, okay? A lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure you're up to speed and informed. So here's tonight's edition of Mark Maron Show Short Order News. A sex expert at the retrial of a German cannibal jailed for killing a man and feeding on his flesh says the defendant was motivated by his victim's wish to be eaten. At an earlier hearing in January, the cannibal told judges how he had severed his victim's penis and how they both had tried to eat it without success. Yeah, a lot of people are like that. It's one thing to put it in your mouth, but it's quite another to swallow. Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, the public lovebirds dubbed Tomcat by the media, had a baby girl Tuesday. People were speculating that Tom might actually eat the placenta, but only because human placenta is a delicacy on his home planet. Scott McClellan, the calm voice of an embattled White House throughout most of the tumultuous times of the Bush administration, announced today that he will step down as press secretary to President Bush. Bush said he thought McClellan, quote, handled his assignment with class and integrity, end quote. So you can see why he had to go. Class and integrity. That's why do I crumple these up? I have to save them. But look, Jim.
Texture. Brings texture to the show.
Yeah, the texture that you
texture.
Used to bring.
Texture.
Texture. There's a. You like the way I use that word? Are you mocking me? Because I use that word a lot.
No,
texture.
I'm not mocking you.
Aural. Aural texture. That's A-U-R-A-L. Aural texture.
Aural.
Aural texture. Tomorrow, man. Tomorrow, man. What a show. These have been packed shows, and I question whether or not we should do three guests per show, because it doesn't give us time to fight, Jim. And despite the fact that we have arguments over fairly meaningless things, and despite the fact
meaningless,
that...
Meaningless things?
You're right. I'm trying to trivialize something that's very real, that there is a very honest tension between us out of our fear to be intimate with each other and candid and just be open to each other. And I think it's a mistake. Some people are pro Mark and Jim fighting. Others think it's childish. But you know what? If we could control it, Jim, then we wouldn't have a problem, would we? Would we, Jim?
I think we can control it. I think we're controlling it fine. You know, I think, you know...
I'm so tired of you, man.
The blog.
I'm just so tired.
You know what? You resent my power.
I'm driving over here and I'm like,
you resent my power.
Jim. Jim again. Tomorrow... From the Daily Kos, Marcos.
I was in your back seat when you were doing that. That's the sad part about it.
Well, that's the arrangement we had, that I would drive you to work like that with you in the back seat. Marcos from the Daily Kos, Marcos Molitzas Zuniga. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right. His book, Crashing the Gate. The director of the new film, Water, Deepa Mehta, will be here in the studio. And from the Marijuana Logs, funny man Doug Benson. Funny man. Did I just do that like a morning radio guy? Good night, sheeple. Oh, shit.